You're listening to a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Both of these two great travel writers, masters of the form, were born and educated in England, and they have both explored and reported on lands quite distant from that green island. Colin Thubran and Pico Iyer are our finest modern chroniclers of Asia. And I'm going to give Pico the honor of introducing Colin, and I get the honor of introducing Pico. Pico is although he was born and educated in England, he grew up in Southern California as well, and we are graced with his presence here at least part of the year. It's like the swans coming back or the cranes coming back. We love it. He's the author of 7 works of nonfiction, including Video Night in Kathmandu, The Lady and the Monk, and The Global Soul, and he's written the novels Cuba and The Night and Abandon. And his most recent book, The Open Road, which we have on sale tonight, describes more than 30 years of talking and traveling with the 14th Dalai Lama. He lives most of the year in the beautiful city of Nara, Japan, though he is usually on the road. Tonight he is here with us. Please join me in welcoming Pico Iyer. Thank you.
Hi, thank you so much. My introduction will probably go on till about 7:55, so we'll have 3 minutes for Colin to talk. But I'm really honored and thrilled to be here. I think there are certain writers who inspire and humble us, especially if we put words on the page ourselves. And there are certain travelers who really transport and amaze us, especially if we take to the road. And I don't think anyone other than Colin Thubran is a hero of so many people, including myself, as traveler, as writer, as novelist, and really also as human being. And I think you all know that for more than 40 years now, meticulously, taking no shortcuts, paying rigorous attention, he's essentially charted the entire landmass between Lebanon and Siberia. He began with relatively short books on Damascus, Lebanon, Cyprus, and Jerusalem. And then in the mid-1980s, he started giving us this epic series of graceful, probing, comprehensive evocations of first Russia, then China, then Central Asia, then Siberia, and now at last Tibet. And I think I can't think of any writer who combines extraordinary erudition with great humanity, and of course that's an unusual combination, nor can I think of any distinguished travel writer who always goes third class, seems to be roughing it in the most difficult places, speaks Chinese when he gets to China, speaks Russian when he gets to Russia, speaks bizarre Arabic when he gets to the Middle East. Those of you who've read Shadows of the Silk Road will remember there he is spending 2 weeks in a Chinese quarantine compound during the SARS epidemic. There he is going through root canal treatment without anesthetic, terrible anywhere, in the middle of rural Iran, unfazed by any of it. And I think probably about 15 years ago, I realized that there are many, many brilliant, evocative, penetrating travelers. But the one I trust more than anywhere in the world is Colin Thubran. Wherever he goes, you sense there's something very honest, patient, attentive, no ideology, no agenda, but he gives us the place just as if we were there. He's also written 7 novels, as you know. He's made documentaries for the BBC. He's currently the president of the Royal Society of Literature in Britain, which is a great distinction. He's won the Mungo Park Award, Lawrence of Arabia Award, the Thomas Cook Prize, all of which, if you take them together, remind you that he's really perhaps the last, but certainly one of the great exemplars of the age-old British tradition of exploration. And I actually got a small example of his stamina just more or less on my way here. A few weeks ago, I got an email from the British Council, and they said, would you be free to come to New Delhi on March 12th for a panel discussion? I said, oh, I'd really love to do that, except I have to be in the LA Central Library on March 17th, and there's no way I could possibly have the stamina to be in Delhi on March 12th and LA on March 17th. To which the British Council rather dryly remarked, well, actually, Colin Thubron is going to be there himself in Delhi. In other words, he was ready to take on the challenge I was shying away from and chickening out of. As it transpires, he wasn't in India last week, so neither of us can claim jet lag. But I think the final thing I'll say is that all of you, I hope, know already that his most recent book, To a Mountain in Tibet, does everything that we associate with him, which is to say, take us to a very difficult, exotic terrain and make us feel at home there. It excavates the religion and philosophy and history of Tibet as well as any book I'm aware of in the last 30 years. It also offers us this heart-stopping account of an ascent up to 18,000 feet. And yet it also does something that we're less familiar with in his nonfiction, which is to show us a little of what haunts Colin Thubron and gives us glimpses here and there of his memories and of his family. And so in that way, I think it's a great consummation of the work he's been doing for 45 years, but it's also a new beginning. So we're really lucky and thrilled to have him here, and please welcome Colin Thubron. Well, a natural place to start, I remember seeing you 2 years ago, and you were just about to launch on this trip to Mount Kailash, and neither of us really knew what it would involve. And I'm wondering how different it was from your expectations, what was surprising about it?
That's quite hard to answer. I don't know what, I almost forget what my expectations were once the reality has occurred. I can't remember in what I first thought and expected. I think I had fears before going, which were partly that the Chinese would prevent me from going because they hate single travellers, and I'd already been prevented from going because of the Olympic riots in Lhasa. And I thought I might get altitude sickness at 18,600 feet. I thought maybe at my age all sorts of old wounds would recur. I had a motor accident with a broken back and a bad knee cartilage and a broken ankle in Syria. All these things you think are going to prevent you doing what is, well, a fairly strenuous physical journey. And that was really what was my expectation. It was more fear, I think.
Yes. Were you afraid during the actual trip? Because it's a very harrowing journey that you describe here.
I was afraid because in Nepal, it was basically a journey up the Karnali River, as you know, the highest source of the Ganges, over the Tibetan border to Mount Kailash. And I was only at 11,000 feet, and I was climbing up the fall of an avalanche and probably hyperventilating. And I suddenly completely ran out of oxygen. I couldn't, there was nothing in the air. Completely bewildering, as if this ordinary element, the air, which we have and assume is going to feed us, just didn't have anything to sustain me. And I just sat down in the rocks and thought, well, if I'm like this at 11,000 feet, what am I going to be like at 18,000? I thought I wasn't going to.
And what came back to you at that moment? I know it's in the book for those of you who haven't read it yet.
Well, this was one of the sort of strangenesses of the journey, because I was travelling with my family in mind, my family, who were all dead. I remembered my mother had just died, and I remembered in particular feeding her oxygen for her failing heart and thinking, well, that is what it was like to find that there's nothing in the air to sustain you. Well, when she was dying, I had to feed.
And there's some sense, it seems, pulsing through the book in which witnessing her death was obliquely or otherwise, the reason why you took off on this trip, would you?
Yes, yes, it was. It was the spur. I didn't even know that I was going to write a book about the journey. It was a journey I felt I wanted to do for reasons which are very hard to make logical, I mean, even in the book.
Yes, because it's an interesting experience, I would think, to go on a pilgrimage surrounded by very devout Hindu and Buddhist pilgrims without being a Hindu or Buddhist yourself.
Yes, it sounds curious, and I wish I could explain it better. I mean, I'm an agnostic, and here I was with a nostalgia for the Christian idea of the afterlife, the love or the longing that I guess we all have that those who we've loved and who have died should in some way continue as individuals with individual memory, individual character. And I couldn't believe it. I was traveling in this state of suspended belief, if you like, but going to a mountain that was holy to others, holy to a fifth of mankind, all Hindus and Buddhists, whose tradition is entirely different and is not brings no comfort to somebody from a Christian tradition, because, of course, they don't believe either in the survival of the individual. They believe in the good or the lesser good of karma, which is carried forward after a death. Yes. But there's no individual memory that survives there.
And there's a sense that you had to make this trip to this particular place in order to come to terms with the losses that you've just been through in your life. Did you feel that? Or?
Yes. I don't know about come to terms with, even. It was almost like a journey of meditation. I thought it was a kind of break from my ordinary life. It seemed wrong to go on as if nothing more had happened. And so I simply... On a sort of Vishkal level, I wanted to go to somewhere that was holy. And years ago, an Indian woman had told me about Mount Kailash, this strange mountain that exists north of the Himalaya somewhere on its own, as if set down by divine intent. And I didn't want to go to Jerusalem, say, or Canterbury, or somewhere that had a where God was supposed to have walked in history, or somewhere where that had any sort of dogma or specific faith. And because Kailash is, I think, to Buddhists, the mountain itself is holy, and they people it with all sorts of gods. But actually, it's the thing itself, this object in the landscape, that yes. is really holy.
And it's interesting, because as I understand it, it's associated with Shiva for the Hindus, with the Buddha and many Buddhas for the Buddhists, and also with the god of death. Because one thing that's so haunting about the book is one feels light and holiness on every other sentence, but one feels death constantly, and people die a lot. I mean, I think you actually saw people more or less being helicoptered down.
Yes, one was sort of greeted on the Tibetan-Nepalese border by, you know, porters carrying down the corpse of a Hindu pilgrim. Eight of them died on the mountain when I was there. These were Hindus who were coming from the Indian plains. They were middle-aged, not fit, pious, and they had no idea what was in front of them. And they weren't ready for this, and they died of oedema and heart failure.
Yes. Yeah. And you couldn't be sure that you would come back from this trip?
No, wouldn't want to dramatize that. I mean, I sort of assumed I would in some state. I wasn't quite sure what state I was going to come back in. But yet I did expect to come back. But you don't know. And altitude sickness in particular is absolutely no respect of fitness, age, gender, anything. It just hits anybody at any time. And the cure, they say, is just to come down from a height, as if there's a nice little escalator going down from the Tibetan plateau to sea level. But, you know, I was waiting to get these headaches, fearful. But odd enough, my Sherpa got them and I didn't. It's extremely odd.
And did you feel when you came down from the mountain as if something had been settled or resolved?
I don't know, because I wish I could say yes. It would make a lovely narrative to say that there was a sort of enlightenment or an epiphany or some sort of catharsis. I can't say there was, really. I don't know. It did change me a bit. And I think it was probably the confrontation with the Buddhist tradition, the Buddhist-Hindu tradition of the afterlife, or of life itself, which is so different from our own, which has a kind of grandeur about it, that they're ready to believe that decaying bodies and minds is quite natural, that these pass into oblivion and that life replenishes itself in other ways. And we from the Christian tradition cling, because we love the dead, to the desire that they should continue in some recognizable form. Mm-hmm. And to be confronted with that tradition and to see it in action to some extent, I think it sounds rather glib, but it made me realize that my individual life was less important too, and that was a kind of liberation.
Because there were all these glinting moments. I think before embarking on the trip, you went to Kathmandu and you talked to various monks. Mm. And as I recall, they all sentimentally are reminding you everything is impermanent, everyone
yes.
dies.
Yes, one monk in particular, he said, you know, Buddhism, it's not a religion, it's not a philosophy, it's a discipline, he said, it's a science. It's the science of meditation, above all, and the realization of the impermanence and the illusoriness of the world. And he said to me, he knew that I was in some sort of mourning, and he said, you know, we have this saying, from all that he loves, man must part.
It's a preparation for death, among
yes,
other things.
Yes, as pilgrimage so often is thought to be. Yes. You know, you leave your home in the world, and you realize it's a sort of way station in your existence. Mm. It is a kind of preparation for death.
Now, you and I actually went to the same high school a few years apart. And I remember the one thing that we were always trained in, you as much as I think, was keep yourself out of the narrative, you know, concentrate on the world. And I was 25 years old before I ever used the first person singular in my writing.
Yeah.
And so it must have been difficult coming out of that background to write what in some ways is quite a personal book about members of your family and poignant memories.
Yes, it was. I've never found it very easy to write about myself in travel books. People always tend to say, you know, that I'm too occluded, that I'm too distant. And after this one, they'll probably say, please go back to being impersonal. But yes, it was difficult, and I think it shows the degree of strain in me, the tension in me, that I was able to do it at all. It sort of broke through the narrative at various points. Mm. And although probably only a tenth of the book actually is devoted to these personal memories, it gets a sort of incommensurate weight to the reader, I think.
Yes.
It's there. Yes, we were always told, keep yourself in the background.
Mm.
It was hard to do that, for that to get. What I thought as I was writing it, though, was that, okay, I'm writing these passages, I need to write them for myself. But when I come to print out, because I write longhand, when I come to print out what I've got, I'll eliminate all these passages. They'll be maudlin, they'll be overwrought, they'll be inappropriate to a travel book. But then when I saw them, I kept them in.
Mm. So there isn't much on the cutting room floor. There aren't more of those passages that you didn't
incorporate. No, They're a little bit thinned down, but that's all.
And I think it's always a little unfair if people are to say that you're occluded, because you do write these novels, many of them, which are very intimate and personal, and I think you can feel that there's a great emotional investment in those books.
Yes, they're sort of autobiographical in feeling, but they're not literally autobiographical in narrative in terms of plot. But I've always, I suppose, with novels, thought that I wasn't even looking for an interesting character or an interesting plot. I was actually going around looking for the power to write the subject, if you like, usually a distress area in one's life of some sort, which would give you the power to write, make it possible, really, to think it was worth going through this arduous business of writing. So I always felt I was like a sort of water diviner going around with a hazel twig saying, where is it? And then some area would say, yes, you know, this is what I've got to write about.
The needle suddenly goes in very deep in one area. Because the subject of your novels is almost emotion in some ways, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the subject of your nonfiction is the world. And in that way, I think you've got this wonderful balance that most of us can't manage.
Well, I think you can, but a lot find it inappropriate. I feel that if I had to write one travel book after another, it would wear thin. I mean, I would wear thin. And similarly with a novel, I love that sort of balance, because the travel books are about one's fascination with the outside world, obviously, often some culture, which is alien but fascinating to me. And the novels are right back from in here. So I go in this mad pendulum, you know, from some fascination with something thousands of miles away to this world that we have in ourselves. And I think that if I wasn't able to do that, I would dry up. One discipline or the other.
And I think one question that comes up in most of your novels and in your last nonfiction book, and that I kept on feeling, and it's sounded at the beginning of this book, is what exactly makes you travel? Because you, I think, were close to 70 when you made this trip, and it's a very arduous trip to a difficult place. Mm-hmm. What propels you into those challenges?
In this case, it was a rather different motive from the usual. It's usual curiosity. I feel that my travel books are not those that tell people about a society, you know, that it is like this. It's not as if I already know before the journey. They are acts of discovery for myself as well. So the narratives are involving me as much as they can in the discovery, in the mistakes you make. I think it's that that I cherish, is the actual personal discovery. I'd never want to go to a country and discover all about it and then write some treatise about it as if I knew. I like the book becomes a second journey almost.
Answering some question that's important to you.
Often, usually I find that either in the course of a search or in the course of the journey itself, I can see the point of the journey. It has a kind of trajectory. Either in the book I wrote before this, which was on the Silk Road, I realized about three-quarters way through the journey what was continually striking me about the Silk Road, which after all goes from China to the Mediterranean. And what struck me all the time was the falsity of national boundaries. Everywhere I went, the ethnic realities, where people were defying what appeared to be there on the map. And you realize the only way to understand these countries is actually to travel through them, to realize that they're infinitely more messy than you suppose them to be. That was that sort of thing becomes the thread of a travel book, or out of a search. When I was in China, I became obsessed with the Cultural Revolution by the enormity and the enigma of what the Chinese did to one another at that time. And it became more and more obsessive. This was 1980s, about 10 years after the end of the Cultural Revolution. So usually in the book, there's a theme that announces itself halfway through, or sometimes in the research, in a book on Central Asia, for instance, these Stans, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, and so on. Obviously, since it was 1991 and the Soviet Union had just broken up and released them, it was about what makes a nation. You know, how did these so-called countries, which were really half invented by Stalin, how do they invent an identity for themselves? So usually there is some theme to a travel book, either discovered during the process or realized in research.
Yeah, and it's only through the writing you can really understand the experience. I mean, every now and then I will try to force myself to take a trip and not take my notebook, and I really get nothing out of it. As soon as I got my notebook out, I'm asking questions, I'm engaged, and figuring something out. And I think you're the same way. I don't associate you with taking holidays.
No, I'm not very good at it. No, the instinct is always to be discovering, to be wanting to know what's people are feeling in this place, or just what the data building is, and everything has to go in notebooks. Mm. I'm hopeless without them. My memory is absolutely average. Yours is probably better.
No, I'm glad to hear. I'm not the only one. And I'm worse than you, because I can't read. Like you, I do everything longhand, but then I can't read my own handwriting.
Nor can I. No,
it's our deformative training.
Yes, yes. Luckily, nor can other people. You know, when the police get hold of your notebooks, completely bewildered.
Yeah. In my case, they always assume it's Arabic, and then they haul me off.
That's good. Then you've had it. Oh, dear.
Now, you actually, at the beginning of this book, you answer the question I just asked you wonderfully about why you took off on this trip. So I wonder if you would read about the motivation for this journey.
Yes, I'll try. It's almost as unsatisfactory as what I've just said, I think. Oh, dear. Authors. Come on. Reminds me of... was it Margaret Atwood, I think, who was warning people about meeting authors because we're so boring? She said, "This for book lovers, if you like pate, don't bother to meet the duck." She said, I sometimes feel the same. Well, there's something here. This was an attempt in the book to explain my motive. The Sherpa that I was travelling with asked me why I was travelling alone. It was quite bewildering to him. And I said, I cannot answer. Sometimes journeys begin long before their first step is taken. Mine, without my knowing, starts not long ago in a hospital ward as the last of my family dies. There's nothing strange in this, the state of being alone. The death of parents may bring resigned sadness, even a guilty freedom. Instead, I need to leave a sign of their passage. My mother died just now, it seems, not in the way she wished. my father before her, my sister before that at the age of 21. The Sherpa's eyes stay mute on me, puzzled. Solitude here is an unsought peril. I joke, nobody's fool enough to travel with me. It's already evening. Our feet grate over the stones. You cannot walk out your grief, I know, or absolve yourself of your survival, or bring anyone back. You are left with the desire only that things not be as they are. So you choose somewhere meaningful on the earth's surface, as if planning a secular pilgrimage. Yet the meaning is not your own. Then you go on a journey, it's my profession after all, walking to a place beyond your own history, to the sound of the river flowing the other way. In the end, you come to rest at a mountain that is holy to others. The reason for this is beyond articulation. A journey is not a cure. It brings an illusion only of change, and becomes at best a Spartan comfort. The Sherpa looks robust, but he stops to complain quaintly of a mosquito bite on his hand, splaying his fingers for my inspection. They're chubby as a baby's, I tell him. We laugh and go on. To ask of a journey why is to hear only my own silence. It is the wrong question, although there seems no other. Am I harrowing myself because the world is mortal? Whose pain am I purging? Not theirs. An old Tibetan monk tells me the soul has no memory. The dead do not feel their past. Meanwhile, the sun is setting with a perverse radiance behind us.
Thank you. And one thing that's always struck me about your choice of destination is that it's remarkably focused. I always feel that if you invite Jan Morris to go to any city in the world, she'll be there tomorrow. Mm-hmm. If you invite Paul Theroux to take any train ride, he's there. Even in my case, if somebody were to ask me to go tomorrow to the Cook Islands or Antarctic or places I have no interest in, I'd be on the plane. But you have really very systematically, it seemed, pursued a whole trajectory. I don't. If somebody asked you to go to Cuba tomorrow or Bolivia, I'm not sure you would to write about it.
I'd feel inadequate. I think I've never felt really that I knew enough. I've always been obsessed by ignorance, mine.
And I suppose it's cumulative. Once you start going to a certain area, you feel sufficiently confident to go back.
Yes, there's a sort of investment in it. Obviously, you attempt to learn the language and you have some sort of historical background and you feel some sort of familiarity with that world, but not with another continent.
And what drew you to the Middle East so repeatedly and intently when you began your travelling life?
Actually, it was just romanticism. It really is quite naive.
Reason.
Yes, I was going with the Thousand and One Nights in my mind. And it was really a fascination with the unknown up to a point, but an unwillingness to write about anything that was so unknown. I mean, I couldn't have gone to Japan and written about it. I was very young, very insecure. And I thought if I go to somewhere like the Lebanon or Damascus, which was my first book, I can read about Damascus over the course of a year, say, and start to know something about it. And so those were the reasons for going to the Middle East, which was sort of half familiar to somebody from Western culture. Obviously, the Greeks and the Romans had been there. There were the Crusades. Our own culture touched on these Islamic cultures too. So I started more tentatively in small places and in a world that was at least a little bit familiar. And then, for some reason, and I still don't understand it, in 1978 I had a bad motor accident. I was lying in hospital, unable to move for some weeks. And I've always found enforced leisure to be incredibly creative in my case. And I started having these bigger ideas that I would perhaps go to the Soviet Union, go to China. In other words, approach huge cultures about which I could know nothing if I studied all my life. I'd never really have much understanding of them. So I was trusting more to my own experience.
And having gone off initially in search of romance, as you put it, then you were going in search of almost hard, brute reality. In
yes, places. Of course, the romance wears thin very quickly, and you become more fascinated by the reality, which is more fascinating than the romance. But in the case of, I suppose, the two giants that I've mainly dealt with, which is the ex-Soviet Union as it is now, and China, I mean, my parents were brought up in the fear of Germany, And my generation was brought up in the fear of Russia, the Soviet Union, and China, the two great then communist giants, the great bear that was going to come and subsume us in the West, and the multitudes of China behind it. And these were big sort of clichés one was served up in the 70s. And I wanted to people the map in a way. It's like comforting myself. I'd love to think that it was a something I did for the world, or tried in a modest way to do for my readers. But really, it was quite selfish. It was an instinct for understanding the forbidden, understanding the enemy.
Exactly, and putting a human face to the other.
Yes, it was such a relief. You know, it sounds so naive, but, you know, with the first Chinese I met, and even the first Russian, it was a huge relief to realize that there was so much commonality between us.
Mm. And you make it sound so casual, as if you're sitting in London one day and then you decide. But I think in both cases you learnt the language before you took off. Right?
Very badly. I went to school to learn Russian. I went back to Polytechnic to learn, above all, spoken Russian. And by the time I was starting to study Chinese, I could at last afford a private tutor, because I didn't have the time, I felt, in my life to learn to read or write Mandarin, which can take years. So I learned the pinyin, which is the spoken Mandarin, which is the romanization of the Chinese characters, and the tones. It's a tonal language, of course, are marked above them. So you learn to read or write, to speak, but never to read or write. So I'm what the Chinese call an illiterate, and with great disdain. But you are. It was very much a language learnt for my purpose, which was to communicate with ordinary people.
And you're also reading and reading and reading in the history of these places.
Yes, I am. There always comes a time, and you know this, when you feel you're being contaminated by everybody else's view of what you're reading. And I never know, I'm never quite sure when to say stop to myself. But there comes a time when you think, no, I've had enough. I must go and see myself.
Because I think, you know, I've been reading about Tibet, as many people have, for 30 years now. And when I read this book, I thought, what's so unusual and unique maybe about it is that it's not written by somebody who's got a passionate investment, let's say, in Tibetan Buddhism, nor is it written by somebody who's very skeptical about this alien faith. But you do a huge amount of research here, and I would say this is the best introduction for a typical general reader into this culture. Yes. But, I mean, you certainly took no shortcuts.
I wasn't aware of taking shortcuts.
I'm always aware of taking shortcuts. So that's, you know, as a fellow writer, that's one of the things that hits me, that I admire.
We're meant to get better at it as we get older, so I should be better than you.
I find it getting slower and worse as I get older. So, do you think of yourself very much in the tradition of great British travellers?
I don't sort of think of myself in those terms really at all, particularly, but I realise I am, because... Yeah. The influences on me were Patrick Lee Fermor, Frere Stark, who was a friend, Robert Barron. I was very conscious of the tradition when I started. Yeah.
And do you think the world has come to such a pass that that particular tradition may have reached the end of the road?
It's hard to say. I mean, people for years have been saying this is the end of the travel book. You know, you get Conrad saying it in the 1920s, yeah. Levi-Strauss saying it in the 1950s, Evelyn Waugh. People have always been saying the travel book's over, just as they say the novel's finished. It's always the death of something. But I think travel writing is a very flexible medium, and it will accommodate. It won't be so much about exploring the unknown. It hardly is anymore, of course. But it's my thing gone. It'll be more, I think, about, well, often, as you have practiced, in fact, finding what's peculiar to a culture under the superficial veneer of the West. It always seems to us as if, oh, everything's been spoilt, everything's homogenized. We travel really for the different, and we don't travel to encounter our own culture. We hope to find something different. And then monotonously, and to our disappointment, we suddenly, or may find, that there's McDonald's just over the water. But I think there's a great future for travel writing in just dipping underneath that superficial veneer and finding what is so intransigently particular about every country. I mean, in England, you only have to cross the Channel 21 miles, and you're in France, and there's no more different culture or mentality from the English. It's absolutely astonishing. But, I mean, you know this better than I do.
Yeah, I'm not sure. But, I mean, one thing that always strikes me in your books is that one way that you get to know the culture below the surface is you seem to quickly get to know people and to draw them out and to hear their stories. Mm. And I'm gathering you always travel alone, probably, do you?
Yes.
Which opens those doors that wouldn't otherwise be there if you were...
Yes, I think people assume if you're alone that you must be lonely.
Yeah.
So they're much more likely to sort of cozy up to you than if you're with some friend. I don't really like travelling with anyone of my own culture for this sort of writing. Mm. It's as if you're in a bubble of, you know, Europeanness in my case,
yes.
And you're validating your own culture together all the time and looking out saying, oh, isn't that peculiar? Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
You know, we don't do that in San Francisco. And
yeah.
But if you're alone, you're compelled to come to understanding more quickly because you're the funny one in the landscape. And so you are not any more sensitive and more vulnerable, but you're also pushed more to realize that your culture is very thin compared to the one that's immediately around you. Robert Louis Stevenson, I think it was, who said, there are no foreign lands. It is the traveler only that is foreign. I love that.
Oh, that's wonderful, yeah. And so you're not the person on the outside judging or assessing. You almost disappear within the culture as much as you can as a
You want
foreigner.
To. You feel that you are. I'm clearly not. But I love you. I like to think that you're a sort of clear glass. You know this is impossible. You only have to look at the work of your fellow travellers to realise that with the best of them, within a few sentences, you know who's written it, you know whose world it is, and that there isn't any real objectivity.
Mm. So you don't... The Guardian in England, just about 2 weeks ago, asked a variety of people, is travel getting less interesting? And it sounds like you wouldn't feel that it's less interesting than it was when you began.
Not really, no. No, it's different. The challenges facing a travel writer are different. I also think that we're so cosseted now that there are whole areas of the world that we just don't feel brave enough to go to. You know, there are big areas of even Africa and Asia that are very hard to travel in, and we don't dare do it. A lot of us. I remember in the 1970s taking a journey, as people did in the 70s, overland from London, in my case, to India. And I went through eastern Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan. I was 6 weeks in Afghanistan, Kashmir, northern Pakistan. This was a journey you couldn't do now. And in those days, the Soviet Union was virtually closed, and it seemed to me that it would never open out. It was a miracle to me when the Soviet Union disintegrated and you could travel anywhere you liked. And China was then also virtually impossible to explore. So it seems that just as one door closes, another opens up.
Yes, yes. And we also now, I think, have more dangerously the illusion of knowing places because you and I could go to our hotel rooms or our homes today and access parts of China that you could never see in person.
Yes, absolutely. And imagine that this is the equivalent of a real experience of the country.
Yes.
That's what's so dangerous, I think, that people look at a screen and think, you know, now we know about this culture without actually being exposed to it.
Yeah. And when we go to China and they're all watching Baywatch, say, we say, how can you judge the LA and the Central Library by Baywatch? But we're doing exactly the same thing.
Yes.
Every time.
Yes, when I was in the Soviet Union, Russia's last was, they were all watching a Mexican soap opera called Rich Men Also Weep, which was a big message to them at the time. And that's what they thought the West was. You know, you'd meet people in Russian villages and small towns, and of course that's the only access they had. They weren't given, it's perfectly understandable that they thought we all had yachts and swimming pools.
Yes, yes. I mean, I know Jan Morris, after 60 years of travelling the globe, feels a little melancholy about the way the world is going. Mm. But listening to you, there's a certain wistfulness that plays through your books, but listening to you, I don't hear that melancholy tonight.
No, I think it's every generation thinks that the world has decayed. You know, I realize now if I go back somewhere, I'm in terrible danger of saying, oh, it's not like it was when I was there and so on. These tedious old men's tales. But I wouldn't want to be doing that.
Because all we're really saying is we're not the person we were when we saw this 20 years ago.
That, unfortunately, is also true, yes.
Mm. And so do you think your writing has changed a lot over the course of your career, would you say?
Yes, probably. I think it's a classic trajectory that when you're very young, your imagination is in tremendous spirits, full steam. And I was over-imaginative. I overwrote, as I still do. And my critical faculties, on the other hand, were rather slim. And I think the balance changes, and that one's critical faculties get sharpened, if anything. I get more self-critical. And maybe one's imaginative powers may slightly get eroded. I don't know, but I find I've got more economical in my writing, I suppose, which is another classic trajectory, I think, that you begin to have more trust in your subject to speak for itself without having to worry about how you're going to deliver it.
Yeah, and sometimes less trust in yourself. I mean, that self-critical quality can be a bit of a liability. Every now and then I think, oh, I wish I was foolish and reckless as I was when I was 20, as a traveller or as a writer, because I would do things then I would never try now. And as you were saying about the imagination, I was the better for trying them.
Yes, I find now, though, that I hate to do what I know that I can do. You know, your publishers, your public, if you've got one, your agent, they all want you to repeat yourself if you've been reasonably successful. They say, you know, deliver the same thing again, and it's death. I always feel now, increasingly, that I want some other challenge. I want to feel that there's something in the travel book or the novel that is new to me, that I haven't done before, that I don't know whether it'll work. No, and that sustains me. I would hate now, because writing's aren't hard. It's pretty miserable. And to be, you know, labouring at something which is just workmanlike and that you know you can do is not anything I feel I'll ever be able to manage.
I mean, I used to think, for me, the act of discovery came in finding some new destination. And now the act of discovery comes entirely in finding a new form.
New way of doing it, yes.
Exactly, a new way of doing it, so I'm not repeating my own tricks. And in fact, I mean, there's a wonderful, at the heart of your novel, Falling, and I'm not spoiling it for the people who haven't read it, there's a man who isn't you, clearly, but he's going back and forth between one woman who's a circus performer and who's all danger and exoticism and recklessness, and another woman who's much more conventional and domestically minded. And somehow, reading it, one always knows he's going to go for the woman without the safety net, because that's who he is, really. And it's interesting you use the word daring, that, I mean, still what is appealing to you is going where you don't know the rules, as it were, and you don't know what you'll come back with.
Yes. No, that's absolutely right. Even in travelling, I find you go that extra step further, and it almost always pays. You know, I don't know if you'll find this, but I've occasionally been a little bit afraid of taking that extra step. And this is literally in the travelling, literally in the writing of it. And you take it, and it is almost always revealing. I've found it again and again that I feel if I don't do that little thing that I'm afraid of, going to somewhere that's supposed to be a little dangerous, that you're failing the country or the culture that you're writing about. It's going to deliver up some aspect of itself that is going to be important and balancing to other things you've written. And almost always, I haven't regretted it. But of course, one can be very foolish.
But you're pushing yourself around the corner and into the places you're afraid of, to some degree.
Sometimes, yes. I mean, not. I don't hope I'm not reckless, but I there's always that instinct that forbidden place is the one that's going to yield up, in a way, to yield up good copy. You know, it's very. It sounds rather mundane, but we're like journalists in a way. We're looking for copy, which can be dangerous too, because you know you feel that, at least I feel that I'm a little bit separate from the right. There's the one who's travelling, and there's the one who's writing, who's sitting on his shoulder watching the one who's travelling. And just as the one who's travelling is being beaten up and having a bad time, the one on his shoulder is absolutely thrilled, jumping up and saying, "Good coffee, we can use this. You know, go for it."
Yes, that's right. Wordsworth said that poetry was emotion recollected in tranquility, and travel writing is commotion recollected in tranquility.
Yes.
The more things go wrong, the better is the material.
The thing you dread is that nothing will happen at all.
Yeah.
And there's just boring, you know, it's fine, dangerous, fine.
Which leads to some treacherous kind of moral situations. I'm sure you find them all the time. You meet somebody who's clearly dangerous and maybe not such an admirable person, and you meet someone who's wonderfully nice. And if you're writing about it, you'll follow the bad one.
Well, then Nelly was more fun, more interesting. Yes, yeah. Frequently. Yes. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to give everyone a chance to ask you questions directly, but one more, because you said something very intriguingly about the labor of writing a few minutes ago. And I'm wondering, did you ever want to be something else, or does the labor ever seem so overwhelming that you think, oh, I wish I were a professor or something else?
No, I think actually I was hopelessly unfitted to be anything else. No, I feel obviously, you know, I'm a writer because I've been a hopeless businessman or anything. You know, writing was all I could do. No, it never occurred to me. I was very lucky in that I at the end of my education, I was perfectly sure what I wanted to do. I always feel terribly sorry, in a way, for so many people coming out and having to make that vital choice in life. You're finished university, and you've got to decide artificially what you're going to do, and you don't know. I was just very lucky. As a child, I was always writing poetry. I loved writing, and I was writing this horrible poetry. And as a kid, and my mother, her family was the family of Dryden, John Dryden, the first poet laureate of England. So she gave me the feeling always that writing was important. Writing was something that was valuable in the world. And then, again, it was my parents. My father was a military man and a diplomat, and while I was a child, he came over here to the States and to Canada for 4 years. And I was at school back in England, but coming over for holidays to Canada and the States. And I never forgot it. It was the excitement of abroad. It was extraordinary. I was a child, really out of war-torn London, everything drab as anything. Never seen a neon light in my life. And suddenly, aged 8, I was in Times Square. And a few years later, looking at the great landscapes of Canada and the great rivers. To a child from small England, it was absolutely, really shattering. And I think I never stopped thinking of abroad as being more exciting than home. And I think that's partly what contributed. And, of course, in my late teens, writing and travelling came together fairly naturally.
And going back and forth, both places were abroad when you were growing up. That's the wonder of it. Yes, both England and North America.
A little bit. You began to see, as one does now, England in another perspective.
Yes. Well, please, if you have questions, fire away.
I'm wondering if the commotion reflected in leisure, at leisure, is your own coinage.
Alas, it is, but I've quoted myself endlessly on that front, so it sounds as if I'm plagiarizing for myself, which I am.
And Mr. Thubron, it's a great honor to have you here. I'm wondering if there are any places, books, or events that you revisit in your memory and that you would ideally like to revisit. In fact, if the possibility weren't unreasonable, and what those would be, especially in Central Asia and Siberia.
Oh, revisiting, I've always found so difficult to think about. I'm always afraid of exactly that syndrome of going back and complaining that things have changed out of recognition.
And
you find, of course, that you then doubt your own memory, as I've done sometimes. My first book was on Damascus, Help, 50 years ago almost, and I've never gone back to Damascus because I loved it, and there's a sort of fear that I'll just be disillusioned. As regards places one sort of literally dreams of and hopes to go back to that had a special tension or appeal, oddly enough, it's the Xinjiang, the northwest province of China, that appeals to me, the Southern Silk Road, which is almost abandoned. And it's extraordinary. These cities that are stuck out in the sands there that were vibrant 2,000 years ago, and you can travel this Southern Silk Road, apart these extraordinary sights and these amazing people who are, you're 1,000 miles within China, and you're seeing people with blue eyes and red hair and leftovers of much earlier civilization. And that's an area I'd love to go back to.
Thank you both for being here. I was wondering if you could comment on the writings of the late Polish writer Ryszard Kapuściński.
I was fascinated by him because, as you know, he's been impugned a lot for inaccuracy, I'm sure you know, and people constantly saying on all his books, particularly I think the one on Iran and the other on Ethiopia, that they were fantasy, that there was, you know, that there was no sort of foundation to them. But what I found always in him, there was a sort of psychological truth that it often transcended the literal mistakes he made, if they were mistakes. And I found him fascinating and very moving, at the same time rather naive in some ways. His last book, I've forgotten what it's called, is a mistake, I think. And some of what he wrote sort of about the sort of philosophy of is a kind of philosophy, I find rather boring, really. But then there are these wonderful things that lift it out of ordinary reportage and even ordinary travel writing. I knew him a little bit, and he was, I thought, a delightful man and very humble. Did you?
No, I always I never met him, but I heard his great gift was for being invisible.
Yes, yes, like Norman Lewis. Yeah.
I'm here. When you were in Tibet, did you feel intimidated by the Chinese troops on every street corner? And also, when you were in contact with the Tibetan people, did you feel that they were intimidated by that, or were they very open with you?
I wasn't myself intimidated by the Chinese soldiers. I never felt that they were going to sort of persecute me. What most struck me was when I was at the base of Mount Kailash, which was my principal experience of Tibet. It was Sagadawa, the Buddhist holy month, and they were celebrating the raising of a ritual pole there, and about 1,000 Tibetan pilgrims. And the Chinese army had followed them in and was sort of bullying them, really. I think they were very nervous that this huge congregation under the mountain was going to become a sort of demonstration. And there were these swaggering patrols of Chinese with batons and riot shields and things, clearly trying to intimidate them. And to me it seemed, and this is sort of really anecdotal and I wouldn't vouch for it, the Tibetans actually looked straight through them. They didn't take any notice of them at all, as if they belonged in another stratum of life. And they went on with their ceremonies and throwing prayer flags, prayers into the air and incense and so on, as if these others didn't exist. I don't know how intimidated they are, really. Of course, they are in many parts. But my own experience was that when concentrating on their religious faith, that everything else went away.
Where do you want to go?
Next? Oh, I think I'm not going anywhere immediately next. I'm thinking of writing a novel. There's always been this pendulum, as we were talking about, between fiction and non-fiction. So I'm sort of going inside for the moment. And I wish that I knew where I was going next, because sometimes I wonder if I have exhausted the places that most fascinate me. But there's not a travel book immediately that's waiting. I'm hoping it'll come while I'm writing a novel.
I just bought the book, so I am missing some details. I'm wondering what year you went. Did you go in from Nepal, or did you cross Tibet from Lhasa, taking a little longer to get there? And once you got there, did you hang out at Milarepa's cave at all?
In 2009, I went in May and June of 2009. I went up the Kanale River from Simikot, which is a little, there are no roads here, so you have to go in on a twin otter aircraft. And then it's possible to follow the highest source of the Ganges called the Kanale, which is a beautiful valley for some days and eventually goes over the Tibetan border. And all the four rivers of the Indian subcontinent rise within about 70 miles of the summit of Kailash. It's most extraordinary, the Brahmaputra, the Indus, and this northernmost source of the Ganges. So you arrive eventually at Kailash this way. Milarepa's cave, yes, I did. It's now enshrined in one of the monasteries around the, I guess it's the north, the eastern slope of Kailash.
I have a question for you. If you can select a place for after your life, the next life, where would you like to choose to be? And what book would you like to write?
Pico.
Yeah, because you said you don't quite believe in the afterlife, didn't you?
Well,
would like to believe.
I'd like to believe. I'm agnostic about it, let's say. And I hope that in a happy afterlife I will be relieved from having to write any book.
And I've chosen my afterlife already. I'm living in Japan, so...
Oh, there you are. Japan and no book.
I also did the hippie trail from Kathmandu to, London to Kathmandu and hitchhiked through Japan. So listening to both of you always brings back memories from many, many years ago. When I saw these two books were here, another brand new book that just came out, Jeff Greenwald's Snake Lake, which tied both your books together. It would have been an interesting trio to have had Jeff up there and with some of his themes. So.
I don't know this book. Is it just out?
Pico may know Jeff Greenwald from Book Passages up in Corte Madera.
I've known him for 32 years, and he was my editor when I first worked for the Santa Barbara News and Review, the alternative newspaper, in 1979. So, yes, I know Jeff well.
Yeah. Writers often carry their own cultural legacy or bias, which is certainly obvious in the great British tradition of travel writing. So I was wondering if you have any your own bias culture from your own culture that inform your writing, if there are any, if you could share with us. And if not, I would also like to know how you have achieved that.
There are lots of questions I wish Pico would answer. The answer is, from my point of view, that I try to eliminate as much as I can of my own culture in my head when travelling, which is partly the reason for going alone. But I also know that I can't and that I don't, and that my work is imbued with a certain tradition. There's no escape from it, and I think if you imagine that you're being objective, you're fooling yourself. As I was saying before, you open the book of any traveller, and I mean a well-known traveller, within a few sentences, you know that's that world, that's Graham Greenland, or that's the robust world of, say, Paddy LeFermer or something, which tells you, of course, that we inform everything we see, hear, experience with our own culture and selves, and it's absurd to think otherwise. I don't know what one can do about it as a travel writer, other than to some extent to acknowledge it. Travel writing has that possibility in it, unique outside autobiography, I suppose, that there's this first person in the narrative, there's the I figure that's walking through the landscape and commenting on it and meeting people. And he's the linchpin and the thread through every travel book. And because he's there in the narrative, he's sort of up for judgment in a way that, say, an academic writer isn't so obviously. You're not saying, this is how the world is. You're saying, this is how I experienced it. This is how it seemed to be. So, in a way, travel writing is one culture looking at another. And I think that's able to be a little bit acknowledged within the fabric of the book itself, that the reader is looking at the traveller and saying, you know, what a horrible person, or whatever it is. So in spite of the impossibility of doing what you suggest, there is the possibility, though, of putting oneself also into perspective, into the picture.
Hi, thank you so much for your comments.
I'm wondering how you feel the course of your career has changed since you first began as a writer. I know you said that looking at a screen can give you the illusion of going places, but I wonder if you're finding yourself connecting more and more before and after you write with the people you meet all over the world.
Did you mean before by literally connecting with individuals before? A little bit more. Before, I hardly personally have any contacts at all. I have a few, usually, with which I travel, but you're going on the whole to other remote areas, in my case, and you don't, you know, people don't say that they know anyone there that you should get in contact with. A few. Coming back, I do find that now it's more possible to make contact with people much more easily. Only this morning I had an email message from a Buddhist monk in Kathmandu who had been very kind to me, and we befriended one another. And that would have been possible 10 years ago, to get a delightful message, a Buddhist monk sending me prayers and talking about the ceremonies they were going to have in April and this kind of thing. And the other thing in my case, that is, in the past it's been hard to keep up with the people that you've seen. In the old Soviet Union, I would not have made contact with them once leaving them. You know, your mail was be censored and monitored and so on. And even in China, the same. But now it's better.
One last question. It looks like there's a gentleman there.
I wanted to ask Pico, since his wife is Japanese, that, and he wants to go back to Japan in his transmigration, that is it something about the fact that the Buddhist tradition and the idea that you don't have to spend a lot of energy in self-maintenance, you know, jibun ganai, that you don't have to think so much about yourself, and yet you're there, but you're really not there, and you don't have any debts to pay, because if you try and pay them, you'll just create new debts. And so what is your fascination with Japan in terms of the Buddhist don't know mind?
Well, that's a beautiful question, and you answered it better than I could. But I think I am attracted to their humility, to their attentiveness, to their gift for listening, to, just as you said, their complete commitment in any conversation to the other person and not to themselves. In 24 years in Japan, I've never had somebody impose her dogma upon me or press her resume on me. It's always the opposite. What can we do to make you comfortable, whoever you are? So I love that. I love the rhythm of the seasons. I love the mix of tranquility and energy, the fact that people are always very quiet, self-contained, but they're always going somewhere and they're always doing something. And in terms of no mind, I would agree that arrogance is not something you're likely to find in Japan, and a wholehearted embrace of ignorance is. In other words, they're always asking. They don't assume that they know everything, and as your question suggests, they challenge what knowing even means. I think there's an innocence there that they don't have to earn, that it somehow is there in the culture. And so when you talk about, I think, beginner's mind and looking at the world with that absolute freshness, Japan has that more strongly, I think, than any culture I know. And I often notice if a group of Japanese people are walking through Times Square, they have this infallible gift for sifting out everything that's raucous, crass, and profane, and finding some moment of sweetness or some light that they can take back to Japan. And you know, those are all qualities that I would love to learn from. But I think what you highlighted, which is the gift for effacing themselves, and for seeing themselves as part of a larger order, and for assuming that they can't impose their will on the world, but they have to surrender to a logic that belongs to something much more collective. I find it very refreshing, having grown up in England and California, which aren't always committed to those beliefs. Now, I think the most important thing about this book, and some of the questions have suggested this, has to do with the tone and the voice and the particular texture. And as you said so well, Colin, reading one sentence, one knows whose it is, and each one of us going to Tibet would come up with something very different. So I wonder if we could end with a reading so that we can go out with your voice, and if you have something you could leave us with.
Ooh.
Sorry, you put your glasses away, but yes, please bring them out again.
I'll see what... May not be very easy, this. there's a passage. Yes, maybe here. This is a strange pilgrimage around this holy mountain of Kailash. The Buddhists and Hindus all go around. It's never been climbed, the mountain. It's too sacred. So they circle it clockwise. And there's a time close to the summit when they see a place that really looks like an old cemetery. And I perhaps read a brief passage from here. Beyond our path, where Kailash hangs clouded and other mountains start to barge in, our way levels out along the riverbank, and we're suddenly tramping through a rubbish tip. Iced and rotted clothes lie snarled in a sprawling mound or strewn over the surrounding rocks. But their disorder is not random. The bleached garments, even the sloughed shoes, were mostly laid here whole and almost new. There are bags, boots, socks, hats. For 100 yards up the nearby slope, the builders are clothed with pullovers and caps. One wears a necklace, another a new silk scarf. Yet another is glued with a tuft of human hair. We are walking across the Vajralagini burial ground, which Indians, remembering a holy cremation site, pack home, call Shivatsal. The plateau above was once a sky burial place. The cairns that cover it appease the restless spirits whose charnel ground this is, and the corpses of those who die here unknown on pilgrimage are sometimes dumped here, their merit assured. My Sherpa, whose faith is routine, circles the cloth heap somberly and climbs on ahead. I wait, catching my breath, sheltering from the risen wind, which is dragging faded garments across the stones. This cemetery, for all its squalid aspect, is for many the heart of their pilgrimage. What is buried here is not physical corpses, but the flotsam of past lives. The shedding of clothes or hair is an offering to Yama, the god of death, that he may ease the wanderings of the dead through limbo towards their next incarnation. Pilgrims may even leave a tooth or shed some drops of blood as a surety that they be remembered when they die. I watch them pass in desultory groups. A man pauses to raise a little pile of stones and places something beneath. A family of shepherds circumambulate the clothes, emitting faint cries, to the spirits perhaps or to one another. Their hair straggles under wide-brimmed hats or flies in shaggy halos. Their dog rolls among the clothes. Later, a young man walks up towards the plateau and places a garment there. He speaks cautious English but cannot quite explain. "You put something precious to you," he said. "You put something close to you." He splays out his hand. "Some people cut off the nails from their fingers. I've just put my favourite shorts up there." I ask gently why. He pauses. The question is somehow wrong. This is simply what you do. At last he points at the sky and says, "Because you will go upwards." I see him climbing fast along the path where Indians are labouring up on horseback into the wind. The meanings of this sight multiply. Some pilgrims deposit a garment of their beloved dead, even a photograph or a pinch of funerary ash, and pray for them in whatever incarnation they survive. Yet the Buddhist living cannot help the deceased, whose souls do not exist. Such hopes fly in the face of karmic law and flower through some inchoate instinct, comforting the mourner, not the mourned. For nothing cherished or even recognizable endures. In this cold, weakened air, I stare a little wretched at the heap of rags, which seem to symbolize pure loss, the loss that mourns the tang of all human difference, of a herdsman's impromptu song, perhaps, the lilt of a remembered laugh, or the fingers that caress a favorite dog. On the slopes beside me, the dressed-up rocks, plucked by the wind, look like dwarfs watching. A few yards away, a bundle of clothes rises to its feet. An old man has been lying there with closed eyes. His sash is askew and the sheepskin lining trickles from his sleeves. Here, people practice their own death. Sometimes a whole party will lie prostrate, overseen by a lama. But now there's only this old man who grins at me and walks on. A little way above us, beneath the grim peak of Shamari, a russet slab of rock named the Mirror of the King of Death reflects back to the pilgrims all their past sins. Some call this a vision of hell. armed with its warning and with the ritual shedding of their dress, their past life, they continue upward. This is the heart of the pilgrimage. Here, it quickens into a more intense trajectory. The pilgrim has passed into ritual death. Both Hindus and Buddhists enter this state. They have 1,000 feet more to climb. Their breathless ascent to the pass of Tara, the goddess of compassion, will release them to new life. Thank you.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.